I grew up in India, and we were a former British colony, and a lot of the books that we read were from England. So many of us we grew up with a nostalgia for the English countryside, even if I had never been there until I was an adult. And I was like, okay, this has to come from somewhere, and it must be from the books we read as kids. So I was like, maybe we could use that phenomenon to create empathy and that urge to protect among a younger generation for the Indian landscape.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, a show where I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. If you're new here, welcome. If you've been here before, thanks for coming back to listen and learn some more. My guest today is Nirupa Rao. Nirupa is a botanical illustrator and National Geographic explorer from Bangalore, India. In beautiful and precise detail, Nirupa uses watercolor illustrations to record and celebrate the unique flora of India. She has worked with the Nature Conservation Foundation cataloging the native trees of South Indian rainforests. And as a National Geographic explorer, Nirupa just published a children's book called Hidden Kingdom, Fantastical Plants of the Western Ghats that aims to help young readers explore the wonderful world of plants. In 2019, Nirupa participated in a plant humanities program at Harvard University. She has also been named an Ink Fellow and one to watch out for in Forbes India's annual 30 Under 30 issue. In this conversation, Nirupa and I sit down at the end of an amazing week in Washington, D.C. at the National Geographic Storyteller Summit to discuss how she found this unique niche of illustrating plants, what her creative process looks like from going into the rainforest to getting back to her studio to do the hard work of these illustrations, and why children's books are such a powerful tool for reclaiming cultural identity. If you want to see any of Nirupa's illustrations before we jump into the conversation and kind of talk about her work, I have a link to her Instagram page at the top of the show notes. So if you just tap on that and then come back, it might just help provide a little bit of context for you. Without further ado, let's jump into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Nirupa Rao.
Okay, our levels sound pretty good.
Yeah, we can start, yeah.
Okay, so we've been at the National Geographic Storyteller Summit all week. Is this your first Storyteller Summit that you've been to?
Yeah.
Okay, same with me.
Yeah.
What are some of your... we're at the end of the week here. Mm-hmm. So what have been some of your impressions? What are you feeling at the end of this week?
It's pretty overwhelming in some ways, because obviously listening to what everyone does is really cool. And some of the people's presentations from yesterday were so I wouldn't even say inspiring, because that sounds cliche, but in some ways, like, did you see Shahidul Alam's talk yesterday?
Yeah.
I almost found it difficult to relate to, because he was just such a cool person. It's like, oh, that's not something I can relate to. That sort of generosity of spirit that he had.
Yeah.
Has. And so that kind of puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think... as it is, everyone is all, and most artists, or I suppose just most people, have some kind of insecurities or some sort of imposter syndrome and all of that. And just to hear everyone else doing what they're doing, it's inspiring on the one hand, and it's also quite scary on the other hand.
Yeah. What's scary about it for you?
I think it's scary in a good way. Like, you know, you just realize how much more there is to do and how much more can be done.
Yeah.
And you'll never really be... you'll never really finish working, if you know what I mean. You just have to keep going.
Yeah.
It's funny, because I was... I met this lady named Alice Tangerini, who's a botanical artist with the Smithsonian. And she's huge in her field. And I'd always wanted to meet her. And obviously, I was super nervous. And there were other people in the room, and they asked her to show some of her work. And she was whispering to me like, "Oh, it's just black and white sketches," you know. Like she was, and I realized that I guess it just never really goes away.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
And there's a. It's funny because there was when you were like walking around the reception halls here at National Geographic, the new like business card is pretty much an Instagram handle.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so funny because it's great that we can exchange Instagram handles with people because then you can actually stay in touch with people and see what work they're doing and kind of like is this constant reminder of who you met and what they're up to. But then you're also kind of going down this social media rabbit hole of like, oh my God, look at all the cool places that person's been. Oh, yeah. Look at all the cool places that person's been. And I can definitely see in this environment, like the FOMO coming up for people and that imposter syndrome too. And, and I've heard from a number of people who are like veterans, like world-class photographers and filmmakers, that same kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what I'm trying to do, not just here, but in general, is to sort of just remove ego from the equation. And I think that makes everything much more enjoyable.
Yeah. Is there a way that you try to do that? Like,
I think my mindset in general is that I just don't take things too seriously.
Yeah.
Like, even though obviously I was speaking on the Nat Geo stage, which is like a huge deal and all of that, still it's just another stage, ultimately, you know, like, so I just try to remove... try not to read into things too much.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's easier said than done and it's like a work in progress, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. I thought that I was curious how it was going to feel this week as well in terms of everyone here wants to be like published by National Geographic.
Yeah.
And pretty much everyone has in some capacity worked at National Geographic.
Yeah.
And it's true that there are like limited resources from this place.
Yeah.
And I know that that can breed some competitive spirit in the group.
Yeah.
And I was thankful that it never felt like that too much.
Yeah,
you know, like it did feel like everyone was supportive of each other. And I think that is a testament to like the way they set up this week of the Storyteller Summit, and also a testament, I think, to the fact that if you're working with National Geographic, you share similar values.
Exactly, yeah.
And so I think that those values outweigh some of the kind of pettiness or that scarcity mindset that can sometimes creep in when you're working with other creatives in this field.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, since I was the only illustrator here.
Oh, shout out. All right.
No, but that definitely helped because there was no competition for me. And also, I didn't really feel that I had to keep pitching for ideas because it's never going to be like an illustration-led article in Nat Geo. And even if there was, I mean, they have their own in-house illustration team, which is incredible. So I don't really think that they outsource too much. So for me, it's more like a question of grants, and grants, I don't think they have a cap on the number of grants, at least not that I know of. So yeah, it's not as competitive as trying to pitch a story that in the way that other photographers would have to do. So I kind of had it easy. I just got to like come in and enjoy the whole thing.
Oh, that's
without
neat.
Any of the pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this show, as you know, is about kind of taking principles from different artistic practices or different storytelling genres and kind of seeing how they relate to other ones.
Yeah.
So from the talks that we saw this week at National Geographic, or maybe a photographer or filmmaker you interacted with, was there anything visually that you saw this week that you're taking inspiration from and learning from for the illustrations that you do?
So visually, I think definitely Evgenia.
Yeah.
Her last name, I'm not
sure. We'll put her full name in the show notes, people.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. I agree. She was amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe you can describe a little bit about what she showed and what was inspiring to you about that.
So she's from Russia, and she grew up in the northern Russia in the tundra region. And so she photographs that landscape in a way that it has a very sort of like a fairy tale quality to it. They look like paintings, so some of them would be inspired by sort of still life, they look like the Dutch masters, or, you know, that genre of painting. And then and she applies those same principles to like those vast frozen tundra snowscapes with like one house in the distance and howling winds. And, you know, walruses at the door, something like pretty bizarre for us, for people like us who haven't seen anything or experienced anything like that. And, or even a house under like a simple wooden structure under like a super dramatic Northern Lights sky. And yeah, so her aesthetic is like, she has that fairy tale kind of aesthetic, but she does it in a way that's not cutesy or twee. And it's such a fine balance that, like, in the fact that she was able to achieve that, it's just really impressive to me.
By cutesy and twee, do you mean like it's unique, but it, like, her style is unique, but it doesn't like call too much attention to itself? Is that kind of what, or what do you mean by that?
It's, I mean, so obviously it's whimsical, but it doesn't have that, like, it doesn't, it's not kitschy. You know, like, sometimes if you're trying to make something whimsical or like magical, you would go for the more obvious ways of doing it, like twinkling stars in the sky or something like that. But she does it in a much more restrained way. It's, I suppose she would actually be able to better articulate what her process is, as to, because I'm sure she's got certain parameters, right, that she adheres to prevent that from happening, because I spoke to her also, and I should have asked her to say exactly what those were, but she did mention that it was a fine line that she was walking.
Yeah,
so it's something that she bears in mind. It's
And so what do you take from that, from like seeing something like that?
She mentioned actually that when she works in sort of photo camps in Russia with kids as well, and she asks them to think through their think through their aesthetic, which is not something that I've heard a lot of other photographers say. I mean not that I've been to a photo camp, but I think like a lot of the time they focus on the technical, or what is the point that you're trying to convey, what is the meaning you're trying to convey, without really discussing the aesthetic. And so what she said is that she asks them to note down things from their culture and from their environment that define their visual worldview, and then when they take photographs to come up with ways to incorporate them in that, so that you get a sort of visual consistency, which I found really interesting.
Yeah,
because obviously, like, culturally, a lot of arts, like traditional art forms, are on the wane. But if we can carry those through in some way, even into modern media like photography,
yeah,
that could be really interesting.
Wow, I love that. That's super interesting. So I want to get back to kind of what you describe as your aesthetic, but I think it'd be helpful to bring listeners up to speed on a little bit about your background and the artwork that you do. So let's start by just going back on where you're from and how you started getting into art.
I'm from Bangalore, which is in the south of India. It's a city which wasn't super big until fairly recently, about maybe 20 years ago. And how did I get into art? It's strange because there's like no one in my family really draws that much. Maybe one of my mom's brothers, but she has seven brothers, so it's not. I used to draw as a kid in the way that everyone does, and then I considered taking art later on in college, but we didn't have art as a subject in school or anything. So I the only concept I had in mind of how to pursue a career in that was to be a fine artist, and the examples that I had were like, say, Dali or Picasso, and I didn't consider myself that sort of personality. I thought that you needed to be this like really flamboyant, experimental sort of person to be in the visual arts at all. Like, even graphic design and things like that were not on my radar, like, you know. So then I was like, okay, this is not for me, and I didn't do it at college. And after college, I worked for like a year basically at a company and I became friends with a graphic designer, and we, and you know, I just realized that I was more interested in her job than in mine. And so then I kind of started to pick things up on my own, and that's how it got, that's how I entered this field at all. Yeah.
Wow. So you were doing, so you started off doing like graphic design using, yeah, using, and when you're, when you talk about graphic design, is that all on the computer? Were you doing things on a tablet? Were you doing things by hand? Like, what's the form that you started to like really, you know, start to practice this art?
So yeah, I mean, I started off learning Photoshop and Illustrator and all of that. And then I realized that I could, you know, put some of my illustrations in, and that that could be a fun way to make things different. So I started doing more of that. And then I discovered there was such a thing as a tablet. And so I got one of those really basic ones, uh-huh, for my, as a birthday present, basically.
Yeah. Like with a stylus?
Yeah, with a stylus, yeah, yeah. And then that just opened up so much. That was like one of my most formative birthday presents, I think.
So how long ago is this, are we talking?
It was 2014.
Okay. And so you had already finished university.
Yeah.
You had like not been doing art, and suddenly, yeah, kind of this spark,
yeah,
just like hit you.
Yeah.
And okay, so how do we go from there to this kind of like niche you've crafted? I'm not doing botanical art. So maybe, okay, now that's kind of like your art path.
Yeah.
Then kind of like what you talked about on the main stage at Nat Geo, maybe you can share a little bit about the relationship to now what you draw.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, now I do botanical art, which is pretty much just plants. Sometimes I'll do animals or insects or something, but usually the plants are at the forefront. And it started, I mean, so I definitely have been interested in nature since I was a kid. It was just a way of life, really, even if I didn't think of it as nature. And on my mom's side of the family, we actually have a lot of botanists. So my mom's uncle was one of the most well-known botanists in India, actually. And he discovered, I mean, no, he documented the flora of the state that we're from. So I had had this quite like romanticized notion of botany in my head, you know, like a lot of adventure and excitement and all of that, which I know that that's an unusual way to think of botany for most people. But yeah, so for me, it was like really exciting. But I never considered studying botany or anything like that. And then it was only when I started exploring graphic design and all of that, that I realized that, I mean, my friend who is a graphic designer, she was telling me that, you know, illustration is your skill more than the computer stuff. And so it was, to be honest, it was actually like my boyfriend who said, he helped me kind of think through the whole thing. And he said, he's like, what is it that you love drawing the most? And then I said, it's, you know, it's flower, I mean, it's plants. And then he was like, okay, so why don't you do that? And again, I had it in my head that drawing plants was just a very decorative, flowery sort, I mean, you know, flowery sort of thing that you just use to, like, you know, paint greeting cards or something stupid like that. And I think there's a lot of associations with, like, sort of subconscious associations with plants, that they're too girly or, you know. But then the more I started thinking about it, I was like, you know, that's not true. Look at what your uncle does with plants. And why don't you explore those plants instead of the more typical plants that you see painted, like the roses or whatever it is? Like, you can actually use it as a way to explore that world of botany. And it so happens that my cousin is a botanist, and he's the same age as me. So that definitely gave me a lot, an inroad into it, which may have been difficult otherwise. So he kind of, you know, he would suggest plants to me and tell me which ones were exciting. And so, and then I was 25 at the time, and then this Nat Geo grant was like for people who are 25 years and younger.
You're like, better, so get, I was like, better get on that.
Yeah, I was like, literally, I think I had 1 month left of being 25.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so, and I didn't have any portfolio. I hadn't been to art school or anything. But I was like, okay, let me paint some plans. And
yeah, let me make my portfolio here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm just going to make a portfolio quickly. And I got the grant off the back of the idea to do a children's book on the native plants of South India. Mm. And I, yeah, illustrated a portfolio for that, and that was enough.
Amazing. So was the story that you shared about doing the illustration of the tree, yeah, was that while you were doing your grant or before your grant? Because I'd love you to share that story.
That was actually simultaneous. So this is at this time I basically decided that I was going to take this plant thing seriously. Okay?
Yeah, which must have been intimidating, right? Like, I'm going to go be like, you probably didn't know any people who are making a living doing illustrations of plants, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't, and I still don't.
So, like, is that scary?
I didn't just jump right into it, in the sense that I didn't quit my old means of income.
Gotcha.
And just like jump in both feet,
right?
You know, I did both simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that made it less scary. I was like, I can do this, and it'll be a side hustle
for sure,
as long as it doesn't have to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then anyway, I went to this plant identification workshop in Kerala, which is like a state in South India.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had this exercise actually where they, it wasn't an art-based workshop at all. It was more of a botany workshop. But they asked us to, you know, take a drawing pad and go like pick any plant or tree or anything that we wanted and sketch it, because the idea being that when you sketch something, you remember all of the details and you notice the details. So I chose a tree and I was sketching that. And then there were these two botanists there who work with trees. And they said, they saw my sketch and they were like, oh, okay, you know, we've been looking for someone who can depict trees. And so would you like to collaborate? And so that's how that project got started. And this was actually while I like, I think, just after I had applied for the Nat Geo grant. And the idea is basically for them, so they run a rainforest restoration program in the Western Ghats, which is like a mountain system in South India. And they grow native trees. And these trees are like really tall. They may be like 140 feet tall. And they're really difficult to photograph because you can't capture
right.
the tree in one
unless you're like
frame.
Right up next to the trunk, and then it's like you're shooting straight up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
You have
so
like
the
no
perspective
real perspective.
Would, yeah, and you wouldn't get a meaningful vision of the tree because you wouldn't be able to see the shape or anything.
Right.
And secondly, like it's the rainforest, so there's a lot of vegetation around it, and so you wouldn't actually be able to see the tree clearly in a photograph. So what we did is we illustrated them instead. So we'd study the buttress of the tree up close. And then if you climb up the hill, you can see the crown above the canopy. And then the intervening bits for rainforest trees are usually just like a plain trunk. Sometimes they may have like branching here and there. But with a lot of it, we had to imagine. So the botanist can basically like fill in the blanks for whatever you can't see, because they know more or less what that species should look like, right? Because
mm-hmm.
they've seen so many trees of that species, even if you're just looking at the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, super cool. And so why did you want to do a children's book with this? Why not like the version of a photography book that's like a coffee table book, you know? Like
yeah.
what was the inspiration behind doing a children's book?
So at one point I interned at you know, Bloomsbury Publishing House in London, and they had in the children's department. And so their children's department is really good. They publish like Harry Potter and stuff. So and they had all of these books that were in collaboration with various British institutions like the London Zoological Society or the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And they have, like, you know, my first book of birds, my first book of trees, my first book of butterflies, and so on. I grew up in India, and we were a former British colony, and a lot of the books that we read were from England rather than from India, especially if you went to an English medium school and you were studying in English. And so many of us we grew up with a nostalgia for the English countryside, even if I had never been there until I was an adult. But you have that, like, weird nostalgia for it. And I was like, okay, this has to come from somewhere, and it must be from the books we read as kids. So I was like, maybe we could use that. I don't know if it was a conscious strategy or whatever it was, but I was like, maybe you can use that phenomenon to create empathy and that urge to protect among a younger generation for the Indian landscape.
From going up there, like, do people have an appreciation of that landscape, like where you were born?
People who live in that landscape, definitely that's what they see every day. Where I grew up in Bangalore, no. So Bangalore was it was a colonial settlement, so cantonment settlement, so that's where the army would have had their base. And so it was a very very influenced by the English. So even the trees that we have there, a lot of them were planted by them, and they would have been brought in from the Caribbean or other parts of the world. So, and usually because they would have, like, pretty bright flowers or whatever it is. Not that you don't get trees with pretty flowers in India. It's just like you cherry pick the nicest ones from all over the place. And so those are the trees that people know, actually, in Bangalore, more so than, we call them avenue trees because they're planted at the side of the road.
Okay.
More so than, like, a lot of the local species.
So a lot of the people who live in Bangalore, what they know as, like, their home nature is actually this kind of carryover from this colonial time.
Yeah.
And so... What were you hoping, like, in your wildest dreams as you started this grant project? What were you hoping, like, an impact could be, even if it was just on, like, one kid? What did you want that impact to be?
I think on a broader level, I wanted them to understand ecosystem complexity. I don't want them to see, like, plants just in isolation, like this one species. Like, I think my idea was that I wanted them to see the difference between, like, a plantation, for instance, and a jungle. Because if you don't see that distinction, then you just go, like, you'll go to the Western Ghats, which a lot of people do on holiday because that's where, you know, we have it's the closest resort location for people in the south.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll just see, like, say, tea plantations, and it just looks like green, and you think, like, nature is thriving without realizing the distinction between a tea plantation and an old growth forest.
Mm-hmm. And so when you started the project, let's dive a little bit into your creative process. I guess we can pick up whatever makes sense to you, whether that you started with, like, the story outline, like the actual words on the page, or did you start with finding plants that are exciting to you? And then maybe we can talk about, like, how do you actually illustrate these in the unbelievable detail that you do?
So it was the first time we were doing anything like it. So I was the lead on the project. So it was me and then my cousin Siddharth, he's a botanist, and my sister Suniti, she wrote the text. And then my friend Prasen, who's also an Archeo fellow, he was a photographer. So he basically, like, came with us on expeditions and stuff. So I think it started with Siddharth and I coming up with a list of plants. So for him, he was like, he wanted to include anything and every, you know, because like, he just, it was like asking a parent to choose their favorite child.
Right. He loves all the plants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but I told him what I was looking for in these plants. I wanted something that had like an exciting story because I wanted to change people's perception of how a plant functions.
Okay, let's break that down.
Yeah, okay.
A plant that has an interesting story. What does that mean?
Like, say, okay, so there's this one plant called the elephant foot yam.
Okay.
And it's a really giant, it's pretty huge. And it's pollinated by dung beetles. So in order to attract the dung beetles, it basically mimics rotting flesh.
Whoa.
If you look at it, it looks like a massive poop.
Wow.
Like it's big and brown.
Uh-huh.
And it emits the stench of rotting flesh. And it also emits heat.
What?
Like as something decaying would, right?
Wow.
So that's its strategy to attract the beetles. So I was
gotcha.
Like, okay, that's definitely a good story. You can't deny that.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I wanted to show that kind of agency that plants employ. People realize there's like a lot going on below the surface.
Right. Or as you said in your talk, like these plants are not just a backdrop.
Yeah.
You wanted to illustrate these plants and kind of call attention to the magic that's within them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So you started choosing different plants.
Yeah. So we came up with a long list. And then I tried to, okay, so it was based on their story and also their visuals, because we wanted things that would be striking. And then I came up with a way to weave the plot line together. So there is no story, but it's like I wanted it to go from one theme to the next. So my themes would be, say, like competition for sunlight.
Okay.
Because it's the rainforest. And then another might be pollination, how to like strategies to attract pollinators. And then another theme would be how to derive nutrients from the soil. So and then maybe defense strategies, you know, like if plants are poisonous. So I kind of like clubbed them into those buckets and then came up with a way to weave the narrative together. And then we went out to actually look for the plants in the wild, because it was really cool to be able to see them and study them up close. And
yeah.
Then also Prasen could take his photographs for it. So we put all of the photographs on a website, which, so, you know, you can read the book and learn about it. And then if you want to go get some like hard facts for like, you know, distribution, size, and local names, all of that, you can get it on the website along with the photographs.
Okay. So you go out into the rainforest. And what does that allow you to access as an artist that may be just looking up the name of that dung beetle plant online? I'm sure there's plenty of pictures of it.
Yeah.
Like, what does that give you access to as an artist that allows it to come to life on the page? What are you looking for?
I definitely, for this book, I showed a lot of the plants in their context, because again, like I said, the ecosystem function of it was something that was important to me to highlight. Going to the location was really important for that. And like the scientific accuracy for me was key. I didn't want to get anything wrong. I took that responsibility quite seriously. And so that way, seeing it in person meant that I could get the texture right, because even if you see a photograph of it online, it might not really show that texture in the way that it looks in person. The relative size of it, yeah, compared to insects that are crawling all over it, or compared to, like, in some of the images you'll see two plants within one picture, one image, so you can see relative size.
And are you going there and are you doing the illustration while you're sitting with the plant, or are you taking a photo, studying it closely, going back and doing the illustration? How does that work?
I do some sketches and things, but then I don't paint like in the jungle, because it's quite wet and
and
there's also like animals and stuff to take into account, so you can't really hang around for too long.
Right.
So I do my painting process is quite slow. So I just do sketches and photographs, and and seeing it in person also helps with composition.
Hmm.
You know, then
say more about that.
Yeah, you get ideas of just like the various possibilities, because I feel like if you rely only on photographs, the likelihood is that the photographs that you see are going to dictate the composition you come up with.
Hmm.
But if you see it in person, then you just get an idea of the possibilities, and hopefully that like results in something fresh.
Mm. Cool. So how long do these illustrations take to make? I mean, they look like they're gorgeous. You know, I'm a fan. And they are so intricately detailed. What's like the timeline, and how many like drafts are you doing? Are you getting feedback, or is it just kind of like, what does that look like?
So I think the toughest ones to do are the leaves. Like anything that involves leaves is like, takes a really long time, because you have to show all the Venetian, and even getting the thickness of a leaf sometimes, and it's imperceptible in a conscious way, like, oh, this is a thick leaf versus this is a thin leaf, because you're not showing like a thickened leaf blade necessarily. You're only showing it through like a slight difference in the shadows that you create. This leaf has a weightiness to it, as opposed to like a papery texture to it. and all of that, again, it really helps to be able to see the leaf in person.
Yeah.
I think leaves, like, I could, if it's a large leaf, I could spend like 2 days on just one leaf.
What?
But like a flower, you can finish in maybe 2-3 hours. Cause
really? Okay.
Yeah. So the flowers don't have that kind of, they don't have the veins and all of that. So
yeah,
it's just like large patches of color, which are much easier.
It's funny to hear you say that the leaves are the most challenging part, because thinking about your illustrations, there's leaves just everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. I'm also drawn to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely discard some paintings. Like there's a bunch of paintings that I did which didn't end up in the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just because, why?
Like maybe the style was inconsistent, and like some of the ones that I did initially, I wasn't happy with at the end.
Mm.
I didn't think they matched. Because this was, if you think about this being one of the first projects that I worked on, my skill was still developing
right
in the early stages. And then by the end of it, it wasn't good enough, in my opinion.
Right. So you use watercolors, right?
Yeah.
Okay. As someone who doesn't know much about painting, my mother paints, and she's amazing. And I'm her biggest fan. And I know a little bit about painting from her. But my assumption has always been like watercolors is kind of this imperfect medium.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, the colors are bleeding into one another. There's lots of like washes and I guess just imperfections.
Yeah.
But as you were talking about like these leaves and how much detail go into like making them perfect, or how much you focus on like the scientific accuracy, I'm wondering why you chose watercolors, how does that decision affect what is finally on the page?
So there's like two main like different approaches to watercolor. One is what you mentioned, which I think is usually called like wet something.
I'd buy it.
Yeah. The idea being that you use a lot of water while you're painting. So even the paper, you'd use cold press paper, which has more of a texture to it, and that's more of a, like, it's a quicker medium, and it's more, like you said, concerned with flair and imperfections and all of that. And then the other form of watercolor is what I do, which is dry brush painting. And that uses hot press watercolor paper, which has, like, very little texture, so that it's much smoother. So when you're painting, you can create more detail. And you don't use much water when you're painting at all. So they're two different approaches to watercolor entirely. So this medium is actually currently in vogue for botanical painting. I mean, there's gouache and there's watercolor. Those are the two main approaches. And the difference is obviously gouache is thicker and it's more vivid. And they use white paint in gouache. In watercolor, you don't use white paint at all. So you just rely on the white of the paper.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. So like leaving empty space.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which can be really tricky. Like if you're doing very detailed work,
yeah,
it can be really, and you can't mess up. There's no room to mess up, basically.
So you can't, like, if you mess up, you can't just like paint over it.
Nope.
No.
I mean, if you mess up in a very light color, then maybe you can camouflage it.
Is there something about like choosing? Do you always work with that type of watercolor? And is there? Do you think that choosing that as your medium makes it approachable in a way to your audience, which was children, mm-hmm. in a way that maybe something else wouldn't?
Yeah, I think that like definitely watercolor has a lightness to it, which is more approachable than say oil painting. It's hard to say that I chose watercolor because I didn't go to art school and I didn't really know what I was doing. So I just like, again, the same boyfriend bought me a class online and for botanical art, and the class taught watercolor. So
amazing.
That's what I did.
Amazing.
It's just sort of happenstance.
Do you have the book here?
Oh, yes, I do, actually. I think I have one book with me.
Yeah. Would you mind, like, reading a page or two?
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right, so Narupa just got the book out of her suitcase, and it is called Hidden Kingdom, Fantastical Plants of the Western Ghats.
Yes.
So how long did this take to all come together?
I applied for the grant in 2016.
Okay.
And then I was doing the other, while I was waiting to hear back from them and everything, I started on that other tree project, mm-hmm. and I finished that while I was doing this, actually. So okay. Then by the time I actually finished this, it was 2018.
So a couple years.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, why don't we choose like a page or two to just read so that we can get a sense of the words that go along with these illustrations. And I will have mentioned this to folks in the intro to this show, but there is a link in the show notes right at the top where you can see Narupa's illustrations to some of these pages, so you can get a sense.
Okay, so I'll read, but I'm not the most like theatrical reader, but okay, I'll read the one that's on pepper. Okay. So pepper is actually native to this region. That's where it comes from.
Okay. Like the black pepper on our table.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the way it grows on a vine, and it looks like a little green berry that you pluck and dry and powder, and that's where pepper comes from. And if you know the history of spices, the spice route to India, it was actually one of the most economically significant plants in those days, because one of the things, the products that brought the Europeans to India, and which was ultimately the what led to them colonizing India, because of the wealth of the country that was represented in what they called black gold.
Wow.
It was that valuable, because it was even used as a form of currency, because it, if you think of what is a currency, it's basically something that has value, that can be exchanged, and which lasts. It's enduring, because pepper doesn't go old easily once it's dried. So it was used as a form of exchange. And it was, I think it was like super, super expensive. I don't have the numbers, but it was like super expensive. So anyway, this is this paragraph that we wrote on Pepper kind of references that. And okay, so it leads on from the previous spread, which was on the subject of nutmeg. And wild nutmeg is also native to the same region. So we were talking about food, and so then that's where it goes on from. As I speak of provisions, there's more in your kitchen, procured from the wild western ghats. Spices, I tell you, commanded such value, they set ships asail to these parts. Just take humdrum pepper, it's native as ever. On old Indian shores it was sold. They came from Arabia and Europe and Africa to purchase the famous black gold. A treasure so precious, it's strange and quite funny, humans were known to use it as money. The powder dried fruit of this climbing vine now seasons your everyday meal. A curious phenomenon that something so common was once history's hottest trade deal.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. That's so cool. So does the whole book rhyme?
The whole book rhymes. Okay. But then there's also like little captions on the side of the paintings that are more scientific. So like alongside pepper, it would say, besides nutmeg and pepper, the Western Ghats are also home to other spices like common cardamom and turmeric, wild ginger and cinnamon.
Hmm. What is something like, this was one of your first like big projects, mm-hmm. and you've been sharing this from everywhere. Like, I mean, you're up on the National Geographic stage, like massive platform that you're sharing, and it's one of your first works, so congratulations on how successful this project has been. What's something that you learned about telling this story and making these illustrations that you're gonna use as a lesson that launches you into whatever's next?
That's a good question. I'm still kind of sort of evaluating the results of this project, because it's just come out, and so I actually decided to self-publish this, which was it was a difficult decision. It's not, I mean, I had plenty of attention from publishers in India, but it's sort of the commercials of it didn't make sense for me, because I think most publishing houses, I don't know how it is in the States, but in India they give you like 10%, and I had a scientifically based project like this, when I had quite a few collaborators who put in a hell of a lot of work, I didn't want to split that 10% four ways. Like, it just would mean nothing, because the margins and like books in India are super cheap, like so the margins on that just wouldn't make sense, and so that would impact my the prospects of working with them in the future. Like, maybe they do it as a one-off passion project, but would they do it right in the long run? So I decided to like do everything myself, literally made the website, got it printed, I post them myself.
yeah
so it's a hell of a lot of work,
mm-hmm.
but I think going through that process taught me a hell of a lot, and the next time I do it, it'll be easier for sure.
And can you share what kind of impact this has had in India? I know you mentioned a couple classrooms that were using the book as an inspiration.
That's actually a different project.
Oh, it is? Yeah. Oh, okay.
So that's an education project that it's a collaboration with another like conservation scientist, who's a friend of mine named Kriti.
Gotcha.
And she basically works in areas that... villages that are like alongside national parks in India.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have a lot of human wildlife conflict because of animals encroaching into human territory and vice versa. And so she helps, say, farmers claim compensation for any crop loss or livestock loss due to animals. And she also leads a sort of sensitization program to help people like live in harmony with their surroundings. So part of that is this like educational curriculum for schools in the area. So I did the plant illustrations for those, and and they turned them into games that the kids could play with. And
very cool.
Yeah. So that's a different project, but my next step with this is to translate this into the local language so that we can distribute it in the same school.
Okay, and then doing like a whole new reprint.
We'll do a separate one in Kannada.
I'd love to pull out some kind of lessons that us storytellers in other genres, like myself as a filmmaker, can learn from your process? And mm-hmm. like, what are some things that we can learn from, like, the way you tell stories in this that you think are applicable to other genres in the same way Evgenia's photography was applicable to you as an illustrator?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and for me, this insight came to me from just thinking about how films are made. Like, not that I've ever made a film, but I was thinking about how much goes into making, say, a period drama. You're basically recreating a world, and so everything from the subtlest, most subliminal details have to work and be convincing. And I think that's something that I thought about a lot. Like, you know, is a font gonna work for these illustrations? Is the tone of the text, we wanted it to sound old world in a way, but that sounding old world is difficult without it sounding colonial. You know, like, we didn't want it to sound like a jolly old Englishman or something like that, but at the same time we didn't want it to sound, because writing in English in India, you could, if you sounded old world, if you wrote it in an old world tone, then it could sound like colonial, and if you write it in a modern tone, then it could sound too American. So we just wanted it to be very neutral sounding.
Yeah, in that way it's kind of reminds me of a number of talks that we've heard over the last week at National Geographic on kind of like communities taking back the narrative that has for so long been written or portrayed of themselves, and like starting to take agency over that. Is that something you thought about a lot about?
Yeah, definitely. Even the aesthetic, like, we didn't, because the Western Ghats is also, it goes through like numerous states in India. It's like Karnataka, Kerala, Tamil Nadu, Maharashtra, Gujarat, Goa. And each of them has its own very distinct aesthetic. So we wanted to be neutral, and we wanted to be old world. But then even if you look at, there's a map in the beginning of the book of which shows the region, which we wanted to look old school, but we didn't want it to look like a, you know, conquistador's map or something like that.
Yeah.
So like all of those kind of subtle things were really important to us to do. We didn't want it to have that impression of like, you know, conquerors coming into the jungle to like conquer this territory.
Right. Another theme that's coming up for me, and again one that we saw this week and I see in your work, is the idea of making the what's invisible to us visible again. Mm-hmm. And the way that we saw that this week, we saw like someone speak, I think his name was Richard Moss, mm-hmm. who was doing photography and film projects in some refugee camps, and was creating pretty familiar images, but he just happened to have access to this crazy, like, military grade camera that doesn't film in color, but films like in heat maps.
Yeah.
And it just, like, the film that he showed, it visually was just like striking because it looked so much different than all the images that we had seen.
Yeah.
Even though it was of the same things that we see before.
Yeah.
And when I saw your work up there, and when I saw it even before the National Geographic event, like, that's what stuck out to me, is you are taking what people see as just like the backdrop of life.
Yeah.
And bringing that to the forefront and depicting it in a new way that makes people like actually pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a filmmaker myself, like, that's huge inspiration to me, of how I can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So before we wrap up, just a couple more questions. I enjoyed hearing that pepper page so much. I would love to hear one more page if you wouldn't mind sharing another one.
Okay. I'll read one from the end of the book.
Okay.
So
we get our beginning, we get our end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this page is basically what I call a shout out to the frugivores. Frugivores. Yeah, F-R-U-G-I-V-O-R-E.
Okay.
So they're basically animals that eat fruit.
Okay.
And in doing so, they help disperse seeds.
Okay.
And so, like I said, the whole ecosystem and the interrelations between plants and other plants and plants and insects and plants and animals, all of that was like important to us to show. So yeah, this comes at the end of the book, and it's just like, oh right, okay, I should mention that the book is written from the it's narrated by a bee.
Okay.
So this is the bee talking, actually. Plants love us insects. We help them spread pollen, you know, since they're rooted and fixed. When you delve a little deeper, it's moving to see how the forces of nature are linked. Civets and hornbills and lion-tailed macaques, elephants, squirrels and bats, these fruit eaters of frugivores join in the circle, carrying seeds to uncharted habitats. By devouring mangoes, jackfruit or figs, they regurgitate or defecate seeds intact. It is said that nutrients in animal poop nourish young seedlings, in fact. One thing's for sure, life's complex out here with its savage yet beautiful bends. But wherever you live, take this to heart. We get by with a little help from our friends.
It's so amazing. And what ways do you think that this type of work can have an impact on conservation and the environment?
I do think that people have been quite blind to plants for a long time, and so I think that I've seen it firsthand, definitely. Like, even when I was getting this book printed, a lot of the people who worked at the printing shop would have grown up in these areas, and I could see them all. I mean, that their job has nothing to do with plants, you know, they're just working the machines most of the day, but they would all, after every like page was printed, they would all like gather around to look at it and say, oh, this is that tree that, you know, I have this in my village. And they would discuss it like that. Oh, you've seen this so-and-so bird come here to, like, this is where it usually hangs out and it loves the fruit of this tree. And that's basically it. Like, I think that people can start, like, I think what we celebrate through our art shows what we value as a society. And for so long, we haven't shown plants at all as part of that. So I'm sort of trying to mainstream it, make it cool again. Make plants cool again, yeah.
That'll probably be the title of the episode, Making Plants Cool Again. Okay, before I ask my last question, where can people follow you, see more of your work, check out your book? Where should we send them?
My Instagram is Nirupa Rao.
You want to spell that for people?
NIRUPARAO.
Okay.
And then my website is basically nirupa-rao.com.
Gotcha. Someone already had the Nirupa Rao? Or you just put the hyphen because you liked it?
I think someone already had it.
Nirupa Rao, if you're listening out there, if you have the URL, let's give it to Nirupa Rao here.
Yeah, give it back to me, please.
The last question I end on is just any last piece of advice you want to leave listeners for, advice that you have for how people in any genre can become better storytellers.
Okay, so this is something that actually seriously almost stopped me from being an artist, which was that I thought that I think the way it's represented a lot in mainstream culture is that you need to have this natural inborn flair that just comes to you like as if you're some kind of genius. But it's hard work, you know. There's a lot of hard work behind it. Like, I think even I realized this when I read about like F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby. His style of writing seems so fluid and very spontaneous, but apparently he really labored over each single word, like every single word he thought about. And that made me realize that even there's a lot of effort that goes into seeming effortless, and there's no substitute for hard work. So you just have to put in the work, and then it'll pay off.
I love it. Nirupa Rao, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
That's it for episode 34 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you to Nirupa Rao for joining the show and to you for listening. I encourage you to give her the follow on Instagram so you can keep up to date with all of Nirupa's amazing work. If you want to hear more from Nirupa, she did stick around for a post-show to answer a few questions that we didn't get to in the main show. To access the post-show, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. For as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all the post-shows with our guests, as well as additional episodes, which will play in your native podcasting app. Every penny goes towards helping keep the mics on around here. Lastly, I would love to hear from you about what resonated in today's episode. What element of Nirupa's craft did you find applicable to you and what you do? You can reach out to me on social at Austin Meyer Films. Thanks again for tuning into the show, and I look forward to seeing you again on the next episode. And until then, go out and tell some stories.